Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has carried out artillery strikes on positions of anti-Iran terrorist organizations in the Kurdish region of northern Iraq. Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian man south of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Details just ahead. Russian foreign minister accuses the West of developing what he calls a grotesque Russophobia to fracture his country. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Top story, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has targeted terrorist bases in the Kurdish region of northern Iraq using artillery and ground forces. The IRGC launched the operation to destroy the positions of the anti-Iran terrorist groups. Move came after officials in northern Iraq failed to take measures to contain the activities of the terror groups. IRGC stressed the defensive operations will continue in order to ensure sustainable border security. The forces holding officials in northern Iraq responsible for upholding the law. Iran has repeatedly stressed it will not tolerate the presence or operations of terror groups along its northwestern border. Tehran's also warned Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. The country will give a crushing response if those areas turn into terrorist hubs. We spoke earlier to journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas about his take on the story. He says the terrorist groups are linked to Israel, from which they receive both training and weapons.
The fact is that Israel is embedded in Azerbaijan in particular. It's embedded in the Kurdish regions of Iraq. It's embedded in the Kurdish regions of Iran. This is a proven fact. The supply of not only training and ammunition and supplies and logistics is going to be linked very clearly to Mossad and the Islamic Republic of Iran. Has been dealing with these particular groups, Kamala and the Kurdish democratic sort of parties. In reality, all of them are being fomented in terms of a desire to break off from the Islamic Republic, just as they are in Iraq. This is the same role that is being played by a lot of the Kurdish groups there. So Iran has undertaken ground operations, you know, cleaned up before. But of course, these borders are porous, and the way that they get in and the way those supplies are ferried is very sophisticated.
Iran has been the scene of demonstrations following the tragic death of Mahsa Amini, a 22-year-old girl who died in the hospital just days after she was arrested by police. However, what started as peaceful protests over her death has given way to riots and vandalism. Yusuf Jalali has your story.
Mahsa Amini, a name that has hit the headlines over the past days for her death in hospital after her detention by the Iranian police over her non-compliance with the Islamic dress code. While demonstrations have been held across the country demanding clarification regarding her death, there have been violent protests and riots leading to clashes with police and acts of vandalism against public property.
It's not about hijab in Iran. What is important is Islam, that Western countries want to get our hijab, our Islam from us.
Those who are rioting are in fact mercenaries who are paid by Iran's enemies. I advise all my fellow Iranians to be wise and cautious and stay away from the seditions plotted by our enemies.
Iranian officials say the death of Mahsa Amini is being exploited by foreign-backed organized groups to instigate chaos and wreak havoc across the country. On Friday, upon returning from New York, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said people's demand will be definitely heard. However, he noted that jeopardizing public security will not be tolerated. 22-year-old Mahsa was an Iranian Kurd from the city of Saqqez in Kurdistan province. On September 13th, she was on a trip to Tehran with her family when she was arrested by police. CCTV footage released by police showed that she passed out at the police station. 3 days later, she died in hospital.
While police have dismissed allegations that Mahsa was mistreated during detention, Iranian authorities have given assurance a thorough investigation into her death is underway. Now, many Iranians say they're all grieved for Mahsa's unfortunate death, yet they say the issue should not divide Iranians and harm national security. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Researcher and activist Hossein Sheikhian blames foreign interference for the latest riots in Iran. Here he is.
Nowadays, and it's for maybe decades that we have interference by proxy groups inside some countries like Iran. If they want to bring up and make a success of their goals, they use them as a tool. The protest is very something very ordinary in every country. People have demands, the society changes. They go up and some, for example, today you want something and the next day you want something else. And you have to demand it. You have to request for it. They are requesting, but the problem and the pain is that the interference of the other countries, the interference of other groups which are paid to do that, doesn't allow the Iranian people to just say their demand in an ordinary way. So that's a pain. We have groups like MKOs and other groups paid by, I don't know, some regimes that I don't want to name. And you see that the a simple request or a simple commemorate, for example, or a ceremony for somebody who has died sadly and collapsed in the police, for example, custody, it becomes a chaos for no reason.
Iran's foreign minister says holding a referendum among all Palestinian people is the only solution to end Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks at a meeting attended by foreign ministers of the non-aligned movement countries in New York. Iran's top diplomat said the referendum will provide the grounds for Palestinians to determine their fate. Amir Abdullahian also called on the non-aligned movement to use its capacities to help stop crimes committed by the Israeli regime against the Palestinian people. And now, more deadly violence by Israelis against Palestinians. Israeli soldiers have killed another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. Victim was shot dead south of the city of Nablus. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent, Mona Candil, for the story.
Well, it seems at this time it could be an accident, a normal accident in a highway, but the Palestinian man who was driving his vehicle crashed his vehicle into an Israeli police vehicle. The Israelis are claiming that it's a suspected ramming attack was carried out in the illegal settlement of Havat Gilad. It's near Nablus. Immediately, Israeli soldiers get out from their vehicle and opened fire at the Palestinian driver. He immediately was declared that he died. It's not clear if he was trying to carry out, an attack or an operation against the Israeli soldiers or the Israeli police officers. But it's every time a Palestinian is killed by the Israeli forces, then the justification would be try to stab or open fire at soldiers or carry out an anti-Israeli operation.
Plight of Palestinians, geopolitics, and culture are being featured at the third edition of the Palestine Festival that's kicked off in Rome.
Rome's suburban Tiburtino Terzo Quarter is once again home to a new edition of the Palestine Festival, a four-day initiative organized by the Palestinian Association of Rome and Lazio Region and the Palestinian Youth Association, created by Palestinian expat Youssef Salman with the aim to foster intercultural understanding and promoting Palestinian culture in the Italian capital. This year's edition of the festival also has a focus on Palestine and Latin America.
Many Latin American countries have been supporting the Palestinian cause. That's what I told to the people who attended the meeting this evening. I also told them about our President Abbas being in New York to discuss a two-state solution. But when will Israel sit at the negotiation table?
A number of Latin American heads of state came out and spoke loudly, proclaiming the rights of the Palestinians and denouncing the Israeli persecution against them at the UN over the past days. At Rome's Palestine Festival, diplomats from the Bolivian, Cuban, and Venezuelan embassies reiterated their support for the cause of Palestinian people in order to restore their legitimate rights. A commemoration of Shirin Abu Akleh was held during a panel on the dreadful living conditions of Palestinian journalists in the occupied territories. Recently, a new forensic analysis proved that the Israeli sniper who killed her could see that Shirin was a journalist before firing the bullet.
In the West Bank, journalists are shot, wounded, or arrested. In the Gaza Strip, there is no internet, no power. We cannot work. Israel simply doesn't want us to do our job. 55 Palestinian journalists have been killed by the Israeli forces in about 20 years. In regards to Shirin, Israeli soldiers knew full well she was a journalist when they killed her. It was a warning sent to all of us journalists in Palestine.
The Palestine Festival will continue on Saturday with an initiative commemorating the Sabra and Shatila massacre and a conference on Italy's and the EU's political stance on the plight of the Palestinians. The festival will end on Sunday. Max Civili, Rome.
The Russian foreign minister has accused the West of developing what he calls a grotesque Russophobia and trying to fracture his country.
The official Russophobia in the West has reached an unprecedented, grotesque scale. They are not shying away from declaring their intent to inflict military defeat upon our country, but also to destroy and fracture Russia.
Addressing the UN General Assembly, Lavrov also said the U.S. is trying to turn the entire world into its own backyard and is throwing a fit on referendums, which are being held in several Ukrainian regions. Luhansk and Donetsk self-proclaimed republics in the east, as well as the Russian-controlled parts of Kherson and Zaporizhia, are holding the referendums on joining Russia. Moscow says it's up to the residents of the four regions to decide if they want to be a part of Russia. The West, however, has strongly criticized the referendums, calling them a sham.
Referendums have begun in the Ukrainian regions of Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson. The voting is set to run for 5 days until September 27. These referendums have been blasted by the West.
The very international order that we have gathered here to uphold is being shredded before our eyes. We cannot, we will not allow President Putin to get away with it.
As members of the Security Council, we must unequivocally reject Russia's attempts to annex Ukrainian territory.
But in contrast to how the media has called it illegal, there are many who are in favor of it. Given this support, then how can the referendums be deemed illegal or a sham? Memories are short as to when this war actually started and how many people have been killed. One figure put the number of people killed to at least 13,000. Another puts it at 10,000. Keeping in mind, these are the number of deaths before the war, which began in the year 2014. Russia had tried since 2014 to reach a diplomatic solution with the West over this conflict. It was called the Minsk Agreement. Why the Minsk Agreement failed depends on who you speak to. The former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych accused Kiev and its U.S. patrons responsible for the poor implementation of the peace agreement. Yet at the heart of the conflict lies NATO's eastward expansion. The Kremlin claims that the West broke a promise that it made in the 1990s not to expand NATO after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Putin said NATO had promised not to expand an inch to the east, promises made to the former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during negotiations between the West and the Soviet Union over German unification. Back in 1998, NATO was confined to Western Europe, yet today it is at Russia's gate. This shows Putin's accusation of NATO's eastward expansion to hold true. Putin therefore set Ukraine as its red line, hence Crimea, and now the referendums that are taking place in these four regions will set up a wall to stop NATO's eastward expansion. Not surprisingly, the outcome of the referendums are predicted to be in Russia's favor.
Now, the fairness of these referendums have been questioned by the West, which has condemned and dismissed them as acts of annexation by Russia. Yet there is no denying that there are many who support holding these polls. They want the war on their territory to end.
By incorporating these four areas, Moscow has set up these regions to be part of its own. As such, Ukrainian attacks to retake them can be portrayed as attacks on Russia itself. And this is where things have taken a nuclear turn. Russia can potentially use that to justify even a nuclear response. The U.S. President Joe Biden addressed that threat at the UNGA.
Again, just today, President Putin has made overt nuclear threats against Europe and a reckless disregard for the responsibilities of the non-proliferation regime.
But the Russian president's nuclear warning stemmed from the U.S. and NATO's nuclear threat first. The nuclear threat exchange is enough to make anyone conclude that there should be a solution drawn up immediately before things get out of hand in this conflict. That, however, was thwarted by the West, who was keen on continuing this conflict. Russia and Ukraine may have agreed on a tentative deal to end the war back in April, but the former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson prevented that from happening. The agreement, in short, would have seen Russia withdraw to its position on February 23, when it controlled part of the Donbas region and all of Crimea. And in exchange, Ukraine would have promised not to seek NATO membership and instead receive security guarantees from a number of countries. The conflict itself cannot end now in the eyes of the West. The profits made from military assistance to Ukraine are staggering. Furthermore, the U.S. is using scaremongering tactics into making European countries, like the Baltic nations in particular, into believing that Russia could target them next for the sake of profits. It was reported U.S. arms manufacturers were not cashing in directly from thousands of missiles, drones, and other weapons, but they stood to profit big time over the long run by supplying countries eager to boost their defenses against Russia. And finally, the U.S. was making massive profits in another area, energy sales to Europe, in particular, gas sales. Some single shipments were bringing in $200 million. The U.S. was now sending 60% of its liquefied natural gas exports to Europe, up from less than 20% this time a year ago. And this is a classic case of U.S. war profiteering.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Here at Arab English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 28th of Safar, the anniversary of the divine ascension of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is also the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace be upon him, the second infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on this day of double grief.
In the limelight.
The heating of Arctic has reached an alarming point, and there is no effort to reduce greenhouse gas by Western leaders. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Common Dreams website reported, scientists have been underestimating how rapidly the Arctic is heating up compared to the Earth as a whole, according to a new study which found the region is growing hotter nearly four times faster than the global average. Researchers at the Finnish Meteorological Institute in Helsinki found that between 1979, when advanced satellite measurements of global temperatures began, and in 2021, the city northern region warmed 3.8 times faster than the rest of the planet, nearly twice the rate that had long been estimated. We are frustrated by the fact that there is this saying that the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the globe, Mika Ratanen, the lead author of the study, told the New York Times, adding, but when you look at the data, you can easily see that it is close to four. Ratanen and his colleagues began examining the issue after heat waves in Siberia drew international attention. A year ago, smoke from wildfires in the region drifted to the North Pole for the first time in recorded history. Climate scientists and the International Energy Agency have warned that humanity must stop extracting oil, coal, and gas and pumping carbon emissions into the atmosphere in order to keep the planet from heating more than 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures. The heating of the globe has caused Arctic ice, such as the vast Greenland ice sheet, to melt at a faster rate than in the past. In addition to pushing sea levels up, melting ice becomes part of a feedback loop in the Arctic. While ice reflects heat from sunlight, water absorbs it, making it more likely that ice that comes into contact with warmer water will continue melting. Ratanen told NPR that's why the temperature trends are the highest in those areas where the sea ice has declined most. Some parts of the Arctic, including the Barents Sea, are warming seven times faster than the global average. The research was published in Communications Earth and Environment as the U.S. House was preparing to take up Inflation Reduction Act, which includes $369 billion for investments in renewable energy and is expected to sharply reduce U.S. carbon emissions. The bill also includes what climate advocates say are major concessions to the fossil fuel industry. Guardian also reported the world will have released more planet heating emissions than have occurred since the Industrial Revolution, an analysis finds. Burning the world's proven reserves of fossil fuels would emit more planet heating emissions than have occurred since the Industrial Revolution, easily blowing the remaining carbon budget before societies are subjected to catastrophic global heating. A new analysis has found an enormous 3.5 tons of greenhouse gas emissions will be emitted if governments allow identified reserves of coal, oil, and gas to be extracted and used, according to what has been described as the first public database of fossil fuel production. The database, which covers around three-quarters of global energy production, reveals that the U.S. has enough fossil fuel reserves to single-handedly eat up the world's remaining carbon budget before the planet is tipped into 1.5 degrees Celsius or more of heating compared to the pre-industrial era. Among all countries, there is enough fossil fuel to blow this remaining budget 7 times over, propelling people and ecosystems into disastrous heat waves, floods, droughts, and other impacts never seen before in human history. Governments have agreed to restrain global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius, but have largely declined to actively halt new fossil fuel leases or extraction. Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the UN, has warned that the pace of the energy transition is not fast enough, with global emissions already returning to pre-pandemic levels. The recent heat waves in Europe, the US and China, as well as the cataclysmic floods in Pakistan, are the price of humanity's fossil fuel addiction, Guterres said.
Food for thought.
Salam. And on the threshold of the departure from the world of the Almighty's last messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, which also happens to be the anniversary of martyrdom of his elder grandson and second infallible successor, Imam Hassan Mojtaba, peace upon him, 39 years later. Here is a statement from the Prophet to enlighten our minds. This grandson of mine is a leader, and Almighty God will arrange peace between two groups through him.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, effects of discipline in Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the effects of discipline in the Islamic lifestyle. We know that Islam is emphasizing on having discipline, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created everything according to a specific discipline. Therefore, when we observe discipline, there are some effects and benefits that we avail from observing discipline. The first benefit which we can count is that we can benefit more from life. Observing discipline gives us the chance of benefiting more from the life, which means that when we are having a specific profession, we have abilities, and if we go through the proper plan and discipline, we follow a proper plan and we observe it with the discipline, we have a specific time for enjoyment, we have and enough time to reach the goals that we set in our life. Therefore, this is discipline that gives us more chances to benefit from the life. Even when we look at the Islamic rituals, we see that there is a discipline in it. For example, there is a specific time for the Fajr prayer, for the morning prayer. For the Dhuhr, which is afternoon prayers, there is a specific time. We cannot pray 1 minute before that time, because if we do that, it is not accepted. For the Hajj, there are specific days. We cannot perform Hajj every day in the year whenever we want. Therefore, there is a discipline in every single thing, and we must perform things according to the timings which are set, and we must follow the discipline in order to reach to the goals that we set for ourselves, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the benefits of the discipline. And we said the first benefit is that we can enjoy life and we benefit more from the life if we are observing the discipline. According to the Islamic teachings, especially when we look at the narrations from Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, he says that whenever you want to plan something, it is necessary to have discipline in your life. And try to divide your whole day in four different parts, your 24 hours in four different parts. The first part is for the supplications with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that we must have a specific time to talk to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to supplicate, to pray, to offer the prayers as well. And this is the first part. Portion. The second equal portion is for earning, and the earnings means that we go out, we earn money in order to bring food for the family, for ourselves. So the second portion is for the work and earning. The third portion is to socializing with our brothers, with friends, with those who are sincere to us, so that they can tell us about our mistakes. They can basically warn us about the mistakes that we have, so we can reform ourselves. And the fourth time is for the enjoyment, for the family. And this is very important, because the fourth part, which is for the enjoyment, for the rest that we need, necessary, it is in order to get energy for the first three things that we mentioned. And it is necessary to equally divide all these timings and to benefit out of it, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
An inflatable building that explores how people would potentially live on Mars has been unveiled in the British city of Bristol. It's a two-story structure with an area of 570 square feet powered by solar panels. It's designed to cope with temperatures as low as minus 63 degrees Celsius. Although the Martian house will be displayed above ground, its lower level will be fully buried to maximize protection against the harsh environment on Mars. Inside, the top floor features a hydroponic living room filled with decorative plants that feed into a circular wastewater system. A team of experts helped develop the design, taking into consideration the complexity of transporting materials to the red planet and what is already there.
So in the gold inflatable structure which you see above you, that's the main living space of the Martian house. It's gold to reflect dangerous solar rays and cosmic radiation, and it's inflatable because it would be filled with a special concrete made of the dust and water that you find on Mars, again to protect you from those dangerous solar and cosmic rays.
The Martian house was envisioned by local artists 7 years ago. The artists also brought together space scientists, architects, engineers, designers, and even school children. The space-age dwelling explores what a house on Mars could be like and is meant to for research and experiments about the future. The major objective of the project, however, is to provoke questions about living more sustainably with the resources at hand here on Earth.
A free climber known as the French Spider-Man scales a 48-story skyscraper in Paris to fulfill a goal he set for himself once he reached the age of 60.
A few years back, I promised myself that the day I turn 60, I have to climb the total tower. Because 60 years old marks retirement age in France, and so I thought this would make a very good nod.
Alain Roberts says this building is not as hard as others he has climbed. The French Spider-Man has ascended over 100 of the world's tallest buildings, including the Sydney Tower, the Sears Tower in Chicago, and the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, amongst many others. Roberts says he spent 2 decades climbing mountains before attempting urban climbs. Using his rock climbing experience, he sometimes carries a small bag of climbing chalk to help him grasp the small protrusions of building walls. Many of his climbs can last several hours. The 60-year-old daredevil says he wants to give people the message that age is a number and one can still be active and do sports. A Palestinian farmer has discovered an ancient Byzantine era mosaic when preparing to plant an olive tree
on his plot of land in the Gaza Strip. The farmer and his son have been carefully excavating the area for 3 months since spring. The pair dug out 3 patches, revealing glimpses of an ornate mosaic with intricate images of birds, flora, and tile patterns. Its full size is roughly 23 square meters. The discovery has set off excitement amongst archaeologists. Experts say it is one of the most well-preserved specimens, with precision in graphics and richness in colors. According to archaeologists, the mosaic pavement dates back to the 5th and 7th centuries. Last month, another Palestinian farmer found a rare stone sculpture while working on his land, which dates back to around 2500 BC. They're back as India has revealed or released several of them into the grasslands of Kuna National Park after a 70-year absence in the country. The 8 radio-coloured African cheetahs made the long journey from Namibia. The big cats were released during a ceremony by Prime Minister Narendra Modi that coincided with his birthday. After their acclimation in the national park, they will be released into a 5-hectare spread of land in central India, covered by grassland and forest. The felines will share the landscape with other animals and roam with leopards, sloths, and striped hyenas. Their reintroduction is the culmination of a 13-year effort to restore the species, which vanished from the country decades ago. Another 12 cheetahs are expected to join the fledgling Indian population next month from South Africa. With more funding, the country hopes to gradually increase the population of cheetahs to around 40. World Cleanup Day unites millions of volunteers, governments and organizations to tackle the global waste problem and build a sustainable world. People in several countries joined the efforts again for a waste-free world. Volunteers were seen in mangrove forests in the suburb of Bangkok. They collected more than 1.5 tons of rubbish in just a few hours. Trash picking events were also held in the Philippines and Vietnam. In Hanoi, hundreds, mostly students, armed with metal tongs and sacks, walked along major roads. They said their aim is to raise awareness about protecting the environment. In Manila, people cleaned up the city's beaches that are major tourist attractions. The annual cleanup day has been running for over a decade. From divers collecting marine debris to children picking up trash on beaches have just one goal: make our planet a cleaner place.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Chinese astronauts are celebrating their first ever mid-autumn festival in outer space while sharing their otherworldly experience with people on Earth. The crew had a close-up view of the moon from China's Tiangong space station and their third month in space. On the occasion, the ground crew organized a series of celebrations, including a family reunion for the astronauts. The ground crew also prepared elaborate food packages that had been prepared before the launch of the spacecraft. Typically, the traditional festival is kicked off by the first viewing of the full moon and the 15th day of the 8th month of the lunar calendar. Despite being able to see the moon rise and set 16 times a day, the astronauts say the moon is special on this occasion. For a forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with menu expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice, and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals. Most of the time, you have to visit an exhibition to see art. But what if art comes to see you instead? Well, a group of artists in Mali have created a floating art venue that will travel up and down the River Niger. It's called the Pirogue du Zem, which is a floating vessel. It's designed to host plays, exhibitions, dance shows, and so much more. The idea is to make art a movable feast that is no longer restricted to fixed venues in cities and accessible to old people. The project was created by a local artist and architect who had a vision to bring art to the masses. The vessel is 20 meters long and 6 meters wide, built with storage and enough space for exhibition. Government officials say the floating venue will showcase Mali's talents and creativity while attracting tourists.
Colombia is known for its tourist attractions and is full of breathtaking natural sights such as beaches, mountains, deserts, and forests. The South American nation is also one of the few places that give tourists the chance to have an encounter with whales. Every year, from July to October, domestic and foreign tourists flock to Colombia's Pacific coast to catch a glimpse of humpback whales. The large animals reach the coast after traveling thousands of kilometers from Antarctica and southern Chile. But for visitors, there are strict rules to help preserve the area and the whales. Tourists are now being welcomed for whale watching after a two-year hiatus due to the coronavirus pandemic. This is also the time when humpback whales start their reproductive process. Art restoration requires intensive research and training and loads of skill. But imagine the anxiety while professionals embark on restoring rare paintings. Under careful supervision, French restorers are working to give back to 500-year-old paintings their former glory. They were rescued from a fire that engulfed the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris in 2019. These works date back from the 17th and early 18th century. The paintings, including 22 with large format, were temporarily stored in a warehouse and now being restored at an undisclosed location. The fire caused strictly no damage to the paintings, but they have accumulated thick layers of dirt and smoke on the surface after hanging in the cathedral for centuries. Some of the works also have paint loss due to overcleaning that restorers say need to be repaired elegantly.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion.
They later ended up in museums in Europe and the US. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism.
Illegal hunting and hybridization with American crocodiles have for decades threatened their populations, with some species being on the verge of extinction. But there are some people who put their lives at risk to save the natural heritage. A Cuban researcher has released a baby crocodile that was confiscated from illegal hunters back into the wild. It was a happy moment for Etienne Perez, who went waist-deep in the dark water of Zapata Swamp to free Cuban crocs, the smallest known range of any living crocodile species. Cuban scientists were racing for quite some time to save the rarest crocodile. The government has protected virtually all of the vast swamp, widely considered to be the best preserved in the Caribbean. But the scientists say more efforts are needed to save the nature.
Releasing crocodile seized from poachers is really impressive because we return the animal to a free life in the wild. In the case of the animals in the hatchery, we are trying to increase the historical range of the Cuban crocodile and, of course, increase the number of these individuals in the wild.
Cuban scientists estimate that around 4,000 crocodiles continue to live in the wild. But because the area they prefer within the wetland is relatively small, a climate-related disaster, increasingly common now globally, could wipe out the brunt of the population. They say illegal hunting for decades is also threatening crocodile populations.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
Former President Donald J. Trump and his allies have given often conflicting defenses of his retention of classified documents without addressing why he had kept them. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Zolan Kano Youngs and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled Trump's shifting explanations follow a familiar playbook. First, he said that he was working and cooperating with government agents who he claimed had inappropriately entered his home. Then, when the government revealed that the FBI, during its search, had recovered nearly a dozen sets of documents that were marked classified, he suggested the agents had planted evidence. Finally, his aides claimed he had a standing order to declassify documents that left the Oval Office for his residence, and that some of the material was protected by attorney-client an executive privilege. Those are the ever-shifting explanations that former President Donald J. Trump and his aides have given regarding what FBI agents found last week in a search of his residence at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. Donald Trump and his allies have cast the search as a partisan assault, while amplifying conflicting arguments about the handling of sensitive documents and failing to answer a question at the center of the federal investigation. Why was he keeping those documents, some still marked classified, at an unsecured Florida resort when officials had sought for a year to retrieve them? The often contradictory and unsupported defenses perpetuated by Donald Trump and his team since the FBI search follow a familiar playbook of the former presidents. He has used it over decades, but most visibly when he was faced with the investigation into whether his campaign in 2016 conspired with Russians and during his first impeachment trial. In both instances, he claimed victimization and mixed some facts with a blizzard of misleading statements or falsehoods. His lawyers denied that he had tied his administration's withholding of vital military aid to Ukraine to Mr. Trump's desire to invest for investigations into Joseph R. Biden Jr. and his son, Hunter Biden. When information contradicting that defense emerged in a forthcoming book by Donald Trump's former national security advisor, John Bolton, Mr. Trump's lawyers switched to insisting that he hadn't connected the aid to the investigations, but that if he had, it wouldn't have been an impeachable offense. Of the multiple investigations Donald Trump currently faces, including a state inquiry in Georgia and two federal grand jury investigations, all related to his efforts to cling on to power at the end of his presidency, as well as civil and criminal inquiries in New York related to his company. The federal investigation into his handling of sensitive documents taken from the White House has emerged as one of the most potentially damaging. A search warrant made public on Friday, 12th of August, revealed federal agents had recovered top-secret documents when they searched Donald Trump's Florida residence earlier in the week as part of an investigation into possible violations of the Espionage Act and other laws. Among the 11 sets of documents taken were some marked as classified, or TSSCI, shorthand for Top Secret Sensitive Compartmented Information. According to an inventory of the materials seized in the search, those types of documents are meant to be viewed only in secure facilities. The inventory of documents included other material, some described as confidential. The stunning revelation made clear the gravity of the Justice Department's inquiry months after the National Archives and Records Administration said it had discovered classified information in documents that Donald Trump had held onto after leaving the White House. "What he doesn't have the right to do is possess the documents. They are not his," Jason R. Barron, a former director of litigation at the National Archives for more than a decade, has said. "There should be no presidential records at Mar-a-Lago, whether they are classified or unclassified, or subject to executive privilege or subject to attorney-client privilege. Documents covered by executive privilege are meant to be kept within the government." A spokesman for Donald Trump did not respond to a message seeking comment. Donald Trump used Hillary Clinton's mishandling of classified material, as seen in the Justice Department investigation into her email practices in 2015 and 2016, as political fodder during his first campaign. He is considering another national campaign for 2024, and questions about whether he mishandled the nation's secrets could be problematic for him, even absent an investigation. After officials with National Archives tried for several months to retrieve material from Donald Trump, he turned over 15 boxes of documents in January. The next month, the National Archives confirmed the discovery of the classified information and referred the matter to the Justice Department. Over the following months, officials came to learn that Donald Trump still had additional material at Mar-a-Lago that some of his advisers urged him to hand over. Mr. Trump described the handover of the 15 boxes as an ordinary and routine process. But administrations have been required to turn over documents to the National Archives before leaving office for more than 40 years, as part of the Presidential Records Act that was created in response to President Richard Nixon's attempt to take his documents and recordings with him after resigning in disgrace. Kash Patel, a former Trump administration official, subsequently justified the handling of the documents by saying that Donald Trump had declassified them before leaving office, a claim echoed by the former president this week. In an appearance on Fox News Channel on Friday night, the right-wing writer John Solomon, one of Donald Trump's representatives for interacting with the National Archives, read a statement from the former president's office